As I mentioned, I came here in the early 90s, and I came downtown, and it's incredibly changed. I can only sort of imagine how different an area like this was. And what you're seeing all over the world is something that quite interesting that's happening at the moment, where there's sort of this shift in how people are living life, doing business, influencing, reshaping cities all across the world. And it's quite interesting when you sort of travel speaking, you see these similarities, things happening, places like this emerging. And I've been really fascinated in the sense that there is this different spirit going on. And there's a different way that people are coming of age now and wanting to, I guess, engage the world. So I'm really interested in the idea of, I guess, this new form of leadership and influence that's coming up that I've sort of broadly called creative leadership. And what's really interesting is that you'll see lots of books sort of defining against different sort of models of influence that went before. You think of the classic corporate influence of the world. You look at the idea of even how malls are set up. There's this particular ascetic, which when put together becomes pathetic. And this particular ascetic is slightly pathetic, but it's that sort of idea of a very sort of standardized corporate view. And in many ways, that's shaped how many cities have looked, it's shaped how many organizations have looked, and it's even shaped how much of Christian ministry and churches and faith has been communicated. And for me, coming from a place like Melbourne, which is a very sort of creative, dynamic sort of place, I've been really interested to see how people's lives go who decide to make this jump across. And what I've seen is I've seen two things. In my city, amongst my friends, I've seen incredibly creative things begin. I've seen people start businesses, do fascinating things with church, show all kinds of creativity in their personal lives. But there's this interesting side story that goes with creativity that I'm noticing. There's almost this hidden belief, or almost an expectation, that in order to be creative, you have to destroy. You hear people talk about this. To create something, you have to destroy. So in some ways, we see people going into the world, and if they're going to create something, they have to define against what went before. They have to destroy the status quo, in a sense. But there's also a personal cost. Some of my most creative friends lead very broken lives. Some of my most creative friends who are just filled with ideas, I can sit with them sometimes and have the most incredible conversations. Yet if I'm honest, their lives are car wrecks. And their lives are filled with this destructive force. And really what I want to talk about tonight, the essence, and I'm going to talk about history and culture and different things, is I think that the move towards creativity, towards urban renewal, towards people starting businesses, doing all kinds of interesting things, is this incredible moment. Yet there's an accompanying danger. There's an accompanying danger that we buy this myth that creativity must be accompanied by destruction. Before I go on, I'm actually going to not just talk the whole time, but this is a conversation for you to talk also with the people next to you. I'm just going to get you to turn to the person next to you. I'll do this a few times and just ask the question, when have you seen creativity coupled with destruction? Maybe in a big sense in terms of how people might do a project? When have you seen it in the lives of people around you? When have you seen creativity coupled with destruction? Discuss. Well, what I'd like to do is I'd like to take this back and explore this idea of destruction accompanying creativity. And I want to go back to a particular moment in history. Now, ballet, when you think about ballet is a refined art. I'm sure that somewhere over this weekend in LA, you could go and see a ballet. What you don't associate ballet with is riots. You maybe associate soccer with hooligans. You may associate ballet with sort of very refined people watching this beautiful performance. But in 1914, in Paris, there was an incredible moment, a riot at a performance of a ballet. The only thing I've found that compares to this is a performance in New York City by the composer Philip Glass, where he played this organ, and I think it was in the 70s, and he just repeated one note over and over and over, and everyone sat there for like an hour, and then one woman went crazy and ran down and started punching his organ, saying, "Stop!" That's as close as I can get in America to a ballet riot. But it was 1914, and Paris was coming to the end of this period called the Belle Epoque, the beautiful period. This was this period where France had not seen war, where the political unrest had died down that France had been going through. You think of France, you think of the French Revolution, you've seen Les Miserables. This incredibly convulsing city was Paris, of these uprisings. The riots that normally happened were in the streets. And if you've seen Les Mis, where the people would put these barricades in the very sort of medieval streets, and the poor would have an uprising. But on this night, a particular ballet troupe had come to Paris. The Ballet Russe, the Russian ballet from St. Petersburg. The Ballet Russe was the most provocative, most modern, most contemporary dance troupe in the world at this time. They were a sensation. This was like the sort of most sensational music star of the day coming to town. But this was before rock and roll had become cliche and predictable. Well, it was actually before rock and roll existed, because it was the beginning of the 20th century. And on this night, people knew that they'd been pushing the boundaries. In their performances, this is 1914, remember, there was incredibly sort of suggestive sexual things happening. But everyone knew that this sort of shocking ballet troupe had something up their sleeve. The Russian composer, Igor Stravinsky, had written this particular piece of music, and it was called The Rites of Spring. And the idea behind the Rites of Spring captured this idea that was developing at the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, that behind all of this civilization, behind all of this stuff that comprised the West, there was something primal and something deep and something powerful, that underneath it, urges and violence and sex lived just beneath the surface. Sigmund Freud was someone who brought this idea to people's attention. He was in Vienna, which was also at its sort of peak at this time. And he looked around and he saw the aristocracy and the generals and all the people in their uniforms. And he felt that there was something fake to it all. And so his writings almost took what people used to look in the spiritual world, where people look for something bigger. They would look outside to God, to celestial beings. And that sort of switch where it went from that to the subconscious, to the inside. And Freud would have these aristocratic women come into his little sort of room there, and he'd get them to talk about things that no one ever dared speak about, which today you will hear on television all the time, about their sex lives, about their secret angers, about who they'd like to kill. And this belief that behind all of this European front, all this European culture, there was something there, something primal, something creative. But to get back to that source of creativity, to get beyond this world which seemed exhausted, almost this act of destruction had to happen. So what Stravinsky did, he wrote this piece of music, and Diaghilev, who was the czar of the impresario of the troupe, they worked on this idea with Nijinsky, who was the lead in the ballet. And it was called The Rites of Spring. And what it was this return to this very sort of primal place. It was almost this pagan dance where the dancers came together, and what they did is at the end of this performance, this young virgin is brought in and she does this dance, and at the end of the performance she's sacrificed. But what was so different about the music was the music didn't obey any of the rules that European music did up to that point. This was atonal, it was completely contemporary, it was jarring to the ear. There was nothing pleasant about this. Up to this point, art in its classical form was always something which was beautiful, something that inspired a sense of the sublime, as Edmund Burke called it, this idea that it took you somewhere magical. But this was art for a different purpose. This was art to shock. This was art to rip back the surface of what was going on. So the performance began, and straight away the audience was shocked by the music. It was just painful to their ears. People looked left and right. What was going on? The people who owned the theater actually turned the house lights on because they thought there was something wrong. And just when they thought it was shocking enough to hear the music, out came the performance. And instead of you think of the very rhythmic idea of dance, which is beautiful and graceful, and again, too, represented the idea of creativity as something beautiful and transcendent, the dancers sort of danced spasmodically. They jerked their bodies around. People actually started yelling out stuff like, get a doctor, they're having a fit. And they weren't saying that ironically. They actually believed that was going on. When the dancers came out and they saw what was going on, fistfights began to erupt in the crowd. In the crowd, you had people who represented the old world, who saw that art should be something beautiful, and there were these young people who saw that art should be something daring and modern and rip back the surface. There were rumors that actual jewels were proposed that night, and men went out the next morning and shot at each other. One story that a journalist tells is of sitting so enraptured by the performance that behind him, another man, so taken by this performance, begins to pound on his head to the beat of the music, and neither of them notice what they were doing. And the entire thing was absolute pandemonium. This was a line that had seemingly been crossed. And it's almost at that point that the modern age begins. This moment where, up to this point, it about being creating things of beauty. Now it's about creating things and destroying and getting back to that world that was behind. In many ways, this was something that was happening all throughout Paris. And in many ways, if you talk about urban renewal, if you talk about gentrification, if you talk about areas being changed and new forms of creativity being brought in, if you talk about the global phenomenon of hipsterism, you have to go back to 19th century Paris. As I just mentioned before, if you've seen Les Miserables, you know that idea of Paris, which was this windy, sort of creaky medieval city where the people were constantly uprising. What the government of Paris decided to do is bring in one of the most radical urban planners who ever lived, a guy called Baron Haussmann. Baron Haussmann lived in the German-speaking part of France, so they straight away didn't like him. And he came in, and his program was this: let's just level the inner city. What do you do with slums? What do you do with these areas where the poor live? Just get rid of them. And what we're going to do is we're actually going to recreate a new kind of city, where what we do is we create these streets. And if you go to Paris, the streets are incredibly beautiful, and the boulevards are wide, and people walk down them and go, wow, this is incredibly genteel and beautiful, and we think of Paris and we imagine those streets. But what a lot of people don't realize is those streets were created wide because it's really difficult to make barricades to keep the troops out if a street's wide. The streets were organized in a way that they could send troops instantly to the poorer neighborhoods to bring down. This was after the French government, when one particular neighborhood had an uprising, the French government's response was to literally point cannons at it, and they bombarded it and killed thousands of people. The survivors who they pulled out of that neighborhood, innocent or guilty, were then shipped off to South America, shipped off to the Caribbean, and basically put into prison, never to come back to France. So what happens is, as France is sort of completely wiped clean, a new type of city begins to emerge. And two things begin to happen. The first thing is that rich people start to move in. With these spaces open, with all of a sudden this new air around the city, people start to move in. Something is planted downtown, which is the first of a kind, the department store. These new stores which are filled with all kinds of consumer goods. You'll notice that the downtown of Paris, there's these department stores, there's opera houses, and they're all arranged in this particular way that encourages this new kind of urban living. And this is where the whole idea that people talk about today of the sort of bourgeois, so the people who lived in these areas, these were the bourgeois, the middle class, the people with money, the people on the up. And what happened was the poor were pushed to the absolute edges of the city. But what this did was, it created another type of person. Because as these middle-class people who liked to go to the department store, who liked all the same stuff, began to emerge in Paris, there was another group of people who began to look at them with disdain. These people would gather around, not around the most popular areas, but they would gather around neighborhoods which were a little bit sketchy. They would gather in cafes. Their thing was not buying stuff in the department store. Their thing was finding really unique and exotic items. And this group called themselves, after the neighborhood around which they were, which was supposedly a neighborhood which gypsies came from, which they wrongly thought were gypsies from Bohemia, actually from India, but they actually called themselves the Bohemians. And this is this whole idea of a new kind of urban citizen who defines themselves against mainstream culture, who supervalues the idea of creativity. And what happened is the defining purpose for this group of people, these artists, these different urban creatives, was to define themselves against the bourgeoisie, the middle class. And all of a sudden, what you see happen in Paris is that idea that you see in Les Mis of the poor rising up and the soldiers coming at them, that almost gets demilitarized and moves across into the idea of fashion, of creativity, of how you view the world. And so this is really, in a sense, the beginnings of what we're seeing around the world now, this aesthetic, which is about defining itself against mainstream taste, which is about, I guess, idealizing creativity. This is a classic painting which captures this sort of moment. This is by Edouard Manet, who's seen this picture before. A few people. This was a painting that came out and was incredibly shocking at the time. There's a couple of questions that need to be asked about this painting. Now, what is shocking about this? Yes, there's some nudity. Probably not the first time at reality there's just nudity on stage, but I'm guessing, I don't go. If you went to the mainstream art galleries of the time, you would see these incredible French paintings where they painted pictures from the ancient sort of Greek stories. They painted lots of pictures of the Middle East. And there were these painters like David and Delacroix and these people. And they were just obsessed with naked women. But all of the naked women were naked women who were in ancient stories. This is a picture that was shocking because here you have a Paris park. And here's a couple of young Bohemian men. Now, it's probably hard to tell that, but the hat that the guy's wearing is a Moroccan fez, which was kind of weird. Why would you wear a Moroccan fez? He's wearing it because he wants to define himself against the bourgeoisie. The clothes and how they're dressed would be recognized by people in 19th century France as people coming from the Bohemian subculture. But the question is, what is the woman doing with no clothes on? This is a park where what happened would people would go and prostitution would occur. So what's happening in this picture is a couple of things. First of all, this is starting to scratch beneath the surface. It's saying, accompanied with this new sort of urban bohemianism, is this idea to pull apart traditional morality. There's a statement here going on that what these men are doing is something which disturbs the moral order. This is not about a family unit. This is not about how Western culture has understood itself. This is a complete reversal of sort of European Judeo-Christian culture up to this point. You'll also notice something else really important about this picture. Whilst it's in Paris, it's in a park. You'll notice in the bottom left-hand corner, your left, that there's this sort of cornucopia of fruit spilling out. You'll notice the trees. You'll notice this sort of allusion to the Garden of Eden, to some sort of primal garden space. What this picture is also doing is it's pointing out this new and powerful idea that's only been around a couple hundred years. This idea started by a guy called Jean-Jacques Rousseau, a Frenchman who existed about 100 years before this, that really the problem with the world is not actually sin. The problem with the world is that we will all be happy if we can actually get back to some sort of garden primitive utopia. That actually what makes all of you sick is the fact that you have to follow rules. What makes all of us sick is structures. What makes us sick is conventions. What makes us sick is traditions. And these are actually the things that make us unhappy as people, that make us do wrong things. So what you have going on is this undoing of the idea of original sin as it's understood in the Christian tradition. And what it says is actually what you need to do to be a happier person is you actually need to break rules. You need to break conventions. You need to get back and destroy and get. And you see this consistently in Hollywood movies. You see this in Disney films. This idea that what we need to do to be happy is to get back to a state of nature, of being without rules. Turn to the person next to you. Where have you seen that sort of myth, that narrative told in popular culture? Where have you heard it around us? One quick one, food. Chia seeds, anyone? If you look at the moment, there's this I'll let you talk for a second. I'll just go on to food for 1 second. There's this incredible belief at the moment, and it's true to an extent, that what you eat is what you are. But the levels into which it's going, there's this belief that if we can get back to food, to different ways of eating and living, that's almost in this primal, pristine state, that's a form of sort of reduced salvation in a way. Maybe I'm wrong. Turn to the person next to you. Feel free to totally critique me on that one and discuss. Where have you seen the idea that to be happy, we've got to get back to a primal state? There is a clue to all of this, which is actually more deeper and more ancient. When Paris was redeveloped in Montmartre, there's the sort of basilica on top of the hill there, the Sacré-Cœur. And it, on the top of it, has a statue. The statue is of an angel fighting a dragon. This is a statue that you'll see in lots of places in Europe. Some of the saints change. This is the classic English sort of symbol of St. George killing the dragon. And this idea is actually something which goes way, way back. It's this idea of a powerful warrior, hero, God-like person who descends with power and order and authority from the sky and battles with a dragon or a snake or a sea creature or a leviathan. And the leviathan represents chaos and creativity, latent sexual power, the darkness, that stuff underneath the surface. And this battle is called the Chaos Kampf, German for the struggle with chaos. This is an idea that if you look back at the ancient Babylonian stories, in the stories of the people who surrounded the people of God in the Old Testament, this was one of their most famous stories. And the Enuma Elish, the ancient Babylonian writings, they tell of this battle. The creation myth of the world doesn't begin with a God creating humans in his image. It begins as part of this struggle. It begins as part of the Chaos Kampf, where gods who don't want to no longer be slaves are sort of born out of this battle between one God and another God. And through that battle, the sort of blood spills and the earth is formed. And this battle, I realized as I read about it, is I actually think something which is so true, not just of our culture, but of ourselves. Inside of us, at this point in history, we have so many things going on beneath the surface. We live in two different worlds. We live in one world where we go to work. We go to our place of employment, and there we have to be responsible. We have to have order. We have to be under authority or perhaps use authority. If you go to your workplace, it's a place which likes, even if it's a creative thing, at the end of the day, you still need to make money. You still need to pay your taxes. And most of our working life is shaped by this idea embodied in that heroic leader. As a culture, we love our leaders, our presidents, to be that figure. If you think of that moment I just realized I'm talking about politics in America. Anyway, I'll continue. We just hate all our politicians in Australia, so you can just talk about anyone. It's great. You have that moment at Millennium Park in Chicago where Obama walks out and it's almost like he's floating on air. And there's inevitably, when I saw that, I just thought there's inevitably, how do you live up to that? This is demigodish. And there's an element, that's not me making any comments on your political thing. I apologize if that tripped on any toes. But I'm continuing with my point, that it's this idea that humans can't live up to this idea that we want the hero. Females want the hero. Often the men females are with can't live up to the expectations put on them. There's something in us which wants this person who's going to come out of the sky. Guys, feel the pressure to be that. I think we have a whole generation of men who are actually switching off and disappearing into the world of Xbox because it's a heck of a lot easier to be a hero doing. Do they still do this? Or is it just like that? And it's a heck of a lot easier to be a hero in a computer game than it is to try and bring that into the real world. And we say these things like, every person's a hero and so on. But the reality is when we live our lives, we go to the post office, we walk down the street, our everyday lives don't seem to live up. Sure, people have heroic moments where a firefighter rescues someone, but the rest of the time the firefighter's sitting there bored in the station and our lives don't seem to live up to this heroic thing. And then we also live in this culture where we've got that message going on at work where it's be responsible, fill out your tax file, you know, your tax, listen to the boss. And then we go home and you watch television, you turn on the internet, and there's this whole other world there. It's like experience your feelings, express yourself. You watch MTV, you listen to popular music, you get on the internet. There's this whole world there of all this crazy stuff on the internet telling us about this very different way of living, that to be happy, we've got to leave our jobs. We've got to go on eco trek through Thailand. We've got to do something crazy. We've got to live these expressive lives. And you see that these two things, that chaos camp, which is gone throughout history, exists in a very particular way today. And one of the ways that this comes out is that we become double people. We become double people. At work, you're trying to be the hero. On the weekend, you're a chaos monster. For some of us, this is our faith. At church, we're trying to live our order, do the right thing, be a good Christian. And in private, with other friends, we're influenced by chaos monsters. We're chaos monsters ourselves. One of the things about this city that I alluded to at the beginning is that if you look at the history of this city, this is a city which has both embodied the hero and the chaos monster. Norman Klein's book, The Erasure of Memory, about Los Angeles, talks about these twin messages about this city. It's the Protestant land of plenty where you're going to come and you're going to escape the dust bowl and you're going to have an orange farm and it's always going to be sunny and you're going to enjoy it. And then there's the people coming from the dust bowl on the train, getting off, seeing the red light district, promising both a sort of kind of heaven and a fun kind of hell at the same time. That founding myth is something which has flown out of this city's biggest export to the world, Hollywood, where you see that idea of the chaos monster, where the gunslinger comes into the Wild West town and he saves everyone, but there's something dangerous about him. Batman is a hero that comes from the sky, but there's something dark and mysterious about him. That's why he has to be Bruce Wayne. Superman has to be Clark Kent. There's two different people just to operate in the world. This is the dominant way that we think about leadership, about influence in the world. Turn to the person next to you and ask them, how have you been influenced by Der Chaoskampf? The birth of tragedy. Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher, after killing off God, says that what we need to do is to hold in tension those two gods, Apollo, the god of order, and Dionysius, the god of drunkenness and chaos. That a way to move forward as a culture is to hold those two in tension. And a whole generation of artists followed that mantra going forward. One of those people who did landscapes, who loved art and architecture, took in 1940 a whistle-stop, high-speed art tour of Paris. This man was a vegetarian. This man loved getting out into nature, following that whole idea that there's something primal in nature that we need to get back to. This man was someone who hated paperwork. He hated that ordered side of life. He hated bureaucrats. He lived for some time the classic art drifter dream of painting, living on the street, hanging out in cafes. That person was Adolf Hitler. In 1940, when Adolf Hitler had defeated France, he paused the war for a morning to do an art tour of Paris. So enamored with the city that he was. This was the culmination of, in a sense, I think, this story playing out. Straight after the performance, almost only months later, of the Rites of Spring in Paris and the Ballet Riot, that desire to go back to ground zero, to return to the primal dirt, came true. As Europe and the world entered into one of the most incredibly destructive wars, at the beginning of the war, particularly in Germany, there was this sense that this was this new modern world that was going to bring this dream of a new world order to pass. Whole generations of artists and idealistic young men came from all over the world, including my country, to come and partake in this. This is Poitiers in France. I've been here. My great uncle is buried here. At this point, Aussie boys and New Zealand boys went, and the ground was literally covered in so many bodies that you couldn't see the dirt. And that dream, that vision of the sacrifice of the Virgin in Stravinsky's The Rites of Spring comes true as an entire generation is sacrificed. The devastation of the war doesn't stop this advance, it only pushes things further. In Germany, in between the wars, this youth movement, turning its back on convention and tradition in the past, takes this idea of getting beneath things and to the sort of primal, natural world. This youth movement was called the Wandervogel, the wandering birds, as young people created the world's first Jugendkultur, youth culture, where they went out and got rid of anyone who was older than them. They went out into nature. They wore sort of folkish clothes. They played guitars and folk songs. They started sleeping with each other and experimenting with sex. They also addressed each other with a Heil. Their leaders were called Führer. And this movement began to turn into something even more dangerous and began to mutate into something that would become the Hitler Youth. And the dream, really, of Nazism was this idea that Hitler wanted to create this Lebensraum, this living room in Eastern Europe. And I heard that in school in history, and I remember studying that, and we heard, you know, Hitler went into Eastern Europe and killed these people because he wanted to create this living space, but I never knew what he wanted to do. His vision that people would live these authentic German lives in farms, listening to folk music, eating good food that they produced in their garden, and living fulfilling, creative lives. Hitler, till the day he died, did not change his lifestyle. His biographer, Ian Kershaw, says, from when he was an art drifter on the streets of Vienna, when he heard that one of his bombs hit a gallery or an opera house, he would cry, but he wouldn't wince when he heard that thousands of people had been killed. And that sort of idea that Nietzsche spoke of that one day would come this artist tyrant who would redeem the world, who would look and rule, balancing order and chaos, comes to its fruition as Hitler goblin-like. And if you've seen the movie Downfall, where he's in those final days in Berlin, where literally Europe is flattened, and that myth that in order to create, we must be destroyed, is laid bare for everyone to see. For me, I realized, much to my disappointment, that so much of how I lived my life had bought this idea. I was so good for most of my 20s and 30s deconstructing stuff. I could talk and I could deconstruct models of church. I could deconstruct models of culture. I could deconstruct people's faiths. And I realized about 5 years ago that the church community that I'd created as a pastor in creative Melbourne actually probably practiced in some ways more destruction than creativity. I realized that I had been enveloped in my own storm. I realized that I was leading two lives. What had been going on for me was that publicly, I was really well known. My name was getting out there in the Australian sort of Christian scene. And I was just being filled with all of these plaudits. I was the young thing coming up. It was going to be a sort of vision of hope for the new way of doing church. And I realized what I was doing was I was actually creating something which was actually not based in stating something positive, but actually stating something negative. And the whole time, what was going on is that my life was becoming more chaotic behind the scenes. At 28, I was diagnosed with bipolarity, but I didn't really do anything about it. I totally ignored it. And I had this weird two lives going on. I wasn't doing anything bad, but I had my friends who I worked in ministry with, and they were ordered and they were good people. And then I had my other friends in my private life, and all of them, which I later found, were either alcoholic or bipolar, and we were just crazy. And when I would talk to them, I would work myself up into this bipolar state. And the problem was that when I was bipolar, particularly on the manic high, that I was incredibly creative. Parts of my first couple of books were written in a manic state where I would turn really fast music on, I would drink heaps of coffee, and I just would pace around my house. And I was able to link all of these things in this incredibly creative way. And people would come and they'd read the book. I will never forget one moment I did this talk. And it was a talk like this. It was in this space, very similar to this. We did it on a Thursday night. It was exactly the same as this, except no fiat. And all these people came, and I did this similar to what I'm doing tonight, but it was at a whole different level. And I was just talking, and it was animated. And I got to the end of it. And people walked out, and I was brilliant, brilliant. You're brilliant, Mark. And I went into the car park, and one of the girls who'd helped me set up the event pulled in the car and said, "Are you okay?" And I said, "No." I said, "I want to die." And there was this expending of the creative thing that was actually killing me. I was giving out, you know, I wasn't looking at my own private world. Things continued to get worse. I got worse and worse and worse, and I didn't do anything about it. I finally had a speaking gig in another city, and I went to a hotel room. And in the hotel room, I fought for 2 hours with the temptation to take my own life. Here I was, well known, and in a hotel room. And I thought, how do I tell people this? I've heard preachers go, often when I'm traveling on the road, there's a lot of temptation, you know, women in the bar and, you know, porn on the TV and all these stories. And I was like, I could say that publicly. How do you talk about the fact that as a leader, you're actually struggling with this incredible temptation to not live anymore? And the next day I went and I told my wife, and I went to a psychiatrist, and he re-diagnosed me, and we talked about a way forward. And he said to me one clear thing. He said, "Mark, what I want you to do is I want you to go home and you need to rearrange your life, and you need to have a very quiet life. You need to give yourself space. You need to have a quiet thing at home going on." About 3 or 4 days after that, my wife informs me that we're pregnant. We're walking out of the office, and one of the girls I work with is like, "Where are you going? You don't just disappear in the middle of the day." I'm like, "Oh, I'm going to an appointment." "What appointment? Where are you going?" "Oh, look, Drew's pregnant." Going, she says, "Oh, congratulations, boy or girl?" And I said, "I don't care, as long as it's not twins." We get to the doctors, and the doctor's got the sonar thing on my wife's stomach. And she says to my wife, "Boy or girl, what do you want?" My wife's like, "I don't care, I just don't want twins." And the doctor goes, "You've got twins." I went home, and I could not work out why God was doing this to me. I'd been told to have a quiet life, and literally twins, if you have not had twins, it is just, there are no words in English nor in any other language to describe. The first 16 weeks, I got 2.5 hours sleep a night, broken in the middle. I just worked. You just go and go and go. I mean, one day we calculated how many diapers you change. It's just unbelievable. It's just everything you're meant to do with bipolar, this is the opposite of it. And I got up the week after at my church, and I hadn't shared about my bipolar diagnosis. People knew I was having twins. And I started to preach. And, oh, sorry, I was just about to go onto stage to preach, sorry. And I could feel like an episode coming on. I thought, "This is not the time, God. What are you doing?" And I remember the last song was being played where I knew I was about to go on. And I got a friend from the neighborhood, and he comes to church, and he's had a really tough life, and he's struggled with schizophrenia. And for some reason that day, I don't understand why, he made a beeline down the aisle, and he stood next to me. I thought, "What is he doing here?" And normally you have someone, you know, "How long do you want to go for? You get your slides, you've got a water. Here's my friend." I thought it was someone asking me something I wanted. And he put his mouth up to my ear and he whispered into my ear, said, "Mark, the rest of the room doesn't know, but you and I are going into psychosis right now. Can you feel it?" That's not what you want to hear. And I went onto stage, and there was a baby about 4 rows back crying. No one else could hear it. And I started talking and I couldn't get my sentence out. And people started to laugh because they thought I was doing some shtick. And I just was completely overwhelmed on stage. And I walked out. And I remember that moment where I'm walking out of stage, I'm preaching, and there's just this look of horror. I can see some of the leaders and the guys on the board. They're just like, they look at me like, and then they're looking at each other like, what do we do now? I headed out and I walked out of the building, and there's a patch of lawn in the car lot. And my brother appeared. And I said to him, I just blew ministry. Who's going to ever get me to speak again? I've blown the whole thing. I've lost all cred. And what I realized was, and I can't tell the whole story, was that I was trying to be the hero. I was trying to be someone fighting the chaos within me. And I couldn't win. In Psalms, there is this image in Psalm 18. And it's a psalm of David. And in this image, what is done is something incredible. where what the psalmist does is it takes the image of the chaos camp, this image that the people, the Hebrews, would have known, and what it does is it completely, in a sense, inverts it. There's this idea of God coming, and God comes in a storm, and David finds God. So in a sense, God appears as this sort of heroic, God-like figure coming from the sky. But in the storm, David encounters God, and God is not this God who just demands that David be a hero. God encounters David in the midst of his storm, and there's this image of God surrounded by clouds with lightning going out. And what I realized with my personal storm that I went through is that there is an end point where you must surrender to the battle and you must give up the struggle between these two myths in your own life. I'm going to tell you a little bit more about how I did that, but I just want you to talk to the person next to you about those themes. How do you feel that battle is going in you? Are you winning or are you losing? Discuss. Because we are so programmed by the great chaos camp stories and mythologies that particularly this city has produced, is what we're used to is if my life was a movie, there'd be some scene where all of a sudden I have an epiphany. I have a redemptive moment. And all of a sudden, I don't know, I'm finally sitting under a tree and I finally have space. Camera pans out, credits roll, sunshine, results. We're used to the hero having that scene where they finally get on top of a building and duke it out and the chaos monster is destroyed. We're used to this idea of resolution and then the story ends. But the problem is our lives are not like that. I don't have one moment here where I go, I had bipolarity. My life was overtaken by chaos. And the next week I got up and I gave the most amazing sermon despite my bipolarity ever. And 20 million people came. And then the movie ends. What I realized is, it's not about a heroic final scene. That's the stuff of the Chaos Camp legend. What it is actually God invites us as his creations into a very different game. He invites us into creating and rebuilding. In order to create the universe, there's a sense where God did have to destroy it. He had to withdraw his presence in order to create. And there is this element that when in doing that, the things could go wrong. And what happened was that because of the freedom, because God in a sense had to withdraw, that the potential for humans to do something against God happens. And if you think of the serpent's whispering to Eve, in which the whole thing falls over, is that temptation, you will be like gods. Chaos monster gods, heroic gods, you will be like gods. And Jesus is the answer to the question of must deconstruction accompanying creation. Creativity, in a sense, is answered on the cross. And I believe what Jesus does on the cross is upturn the mythology. This is not a Hollywood moment where literally Jesus could have brought down the legions of angels, yet he doesn't. He shows this very different way of surrendering. When Pilate confronts him, he doesn't speak with this incredible Hollywood speech. He's silent. On the cross, he's naked and humiliated. And in many ways, it's this complete undoing of that chaos camp myth. Here we have the heroic God coming down, but instead of coming with power and a sense of earthly authority, he gives up. And that's what actually defeats Satan, the chaos monster. And in John 20, we have this beautiful image of Jesus' resurrection, where Mary goes to the garden and finds him. And instead of thinking that it's the risen Jesus, she mistakes him for a gardener. And there's this beautiful image of this graveyard, this place of desolation, the desolation wished for by the rites of spring, the desolation of death that we saw in those images and stories I told of the two wars. And out of that, this seed is planted in the ground of a very different kind of hero. And here is God, the gardener, spreading seeds again of creation. And those seeds are you and I. And what you're called to be is like a gardener in the world, cultivating. My answer to bipolarity is, I think probably I'll have it for the rest of my life. Statistically, you're meant to get worse. And what I realize is there's not this one moment where, oh my goodness, I beat it by just stuffing my entire body with chia seeds. That actually, what it is consistent turning up and sowing seeds every day. Those moments every day when I come home from work and I have to regulate my mood and I go home and the kids are going crazy and my wife is stressed and I stand in that kitchen and I cook and it's just insane sounds and everything that someone with bipolarity should not be exposed to. Every night, they're tiny, heroic actions. Every day, you are called to be someone who is scattering those seeds. I want to just end with a story which I think is the opposite of the ballet riot. Oops, go forward. This is St. Petersburg, which is the city where the Ballet Russe came from. This is the city which spawned the Ballet Russe. This is the city where the Russian Revolution kicked off. And at the beginning of World War II, Hitler, in this quest to create space for his demented dream of nature, tries to invade. He was so confident of his plans, he actually had invitations sent off to his generals so they'd meet in one of the hotels for a victory party. And almost you have this battle going on where the city of St. Petersburg was always questioned by even the Russian government. Stalin hated it, and he would actually take people off the streets all the time. He hated St. Petersburg because it seemed too Western, not Russian enough. So here's this city, completely surrounded by the Nazis, also almost hated by its own government. And in this city, one of the most remarkable music performances ever to take place in human history occurs. The siege, which Hitler expected to achieve in record time, ended up going for 3 years, 900 days to be precise. The population of the city was devastated by three quarters, cut off from any food, bombarded. This was literally a place which turned into a living hell. Not just the hot Russian summers, but the Russian winters. Death became so normal. They just didn't know what to do with the bodies. They couldn't put them anywhere. They just had to pile them around the cities. People would run out of wood because they were chopping it for fires. They had to create these little sort of carriers for the bodies. This was just an absolute common sight. Even while the city was surrounded, Joseph Stalin, the communist leader, was still executing people in the city. So demented was his oppressive streak. There was these stories that people were so used to death, they would be sitting there and eating their meals and their relatives would die in front of them and they just would continue eating. It had become so, so normal. To bolster the effort of the morale, rather, of the city, the leaders of the city decided to put on a concert, which seems like the last thing that you would want to do during one of the worst sieges that humankind has seen. And the composer, Shostakovich, who was influenced by Stravinsky, who wrote The Rites of Spring. What had happened, though, is that Stravinsky had lost his wife and his daughter. No longer did he believe that the way forward for humanity was to turn back to this primal thing. He was now reading the Gospels. He had returned to the faith of his youth. And he wrote these Psalms, these symphonies to Psalms. And he looked at that idea of David finding God in the midst of storm and struggle. And these compositions inspired Shostakovich. And Shostakovich, in the midst of an aerial bombardment, wrote his Seventh Symphony. Shostakovich was the most famous composer in Russia at the time. He was lucky to be alive. Stalin's sweeps of killing people, there was one point where he killed 3/4 of his parliament. And Shostakovich consistently lived in fear of what Stalin would do. There's one point where he's playing a performance and he's watching Stalin the whole time. And there's a bit where the timpanis come in and the drums start and Stalin shudders. And Shostakovich is almost sort of vomiting with fear that he's going to be taken off by the secret police in the middle of the night. But Shostakovich, meditating on the Psalms, writes this incredible piece of music. They gather what's left of the St. Petersburg, or Leningrad, as it's called at that time, symphony orchestra. About a third of them had passed away. And they meet each other, having not played together for some time because of the siege, and they can barely recognize each other, these sort of skeletal sort of figures. The conductor, they said at the first press, it raised his hand, and his hand shook so much they didn't even know if he'd be able to continue conducting. But day after day, these people turned up and practiced and practiced. They made a rule that if your spouse died, you still had to come to practice the next day. And so this performance begins. Just before the performance begins, they pound with artillery the German positions. Around the city, they put on speakers so the Germans would hear. And the audience fills in, these people, thin, bedraggled, barely eaten for days and days and days. The performance begins, and it's this incredible moment. Here are these people who have been prevented by Stalin from going to church, who have no way of expressing their emotions. And this music begins, and it's one of those moments which is absolutely transcendent, because it's not just creativity, it's creativity that hits people at that point, which doesn't just cause them to rip down and tear. This is creativity which is given as something which builds humans up, that takes them back to that idea that there is this wrestle inside of each of us, that God comes and meets you in that wrestle. At the end of the performance, one of the people there who recounts it in an interview says that there was just absolute silence. And then, like a cascading river from the back of the room, this thunderous applause. German soldiers in positions turned to each other reportedly and said, "We can't win." And this is the moment that people who could not even have food count as the moment which enabled them to survive one of the most terrible sieges. One woman, the poet Olga Berholz, who'd lost her family, looked at Shostakovich, this little man with a mop of hair. He looked like Harry Potter. This skinny Harry Potter who had no army, who had no forces behind him, who literally had his gift of creativity and his Psalms, and said, "This man is stronger than Hitler." And each one of you has that potential in you. It is not something that is going to arrive in one heroic moment. Rather, it's a lifetime of surrendering, of 1,000 miniature heroic steps, of living your life as a human and living a life surrendered to God and being a disciple every day.